How do we know carbon dioxide is increasing in the atmosphere? And who says humans are doing it? I'm Alex Smith, and this is the Radio EcoShock Show, right here on Green 960 AM, San Francisco. Our guest today is Peter Tans, Chief Scientist at the Earth Systems Research Lab at NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. He's probably the top carbon tracker in America. Please welcome Peter.
Hi.
Well, just the fact that we got this interview is a sign of better times for climate science. We don't need a Bush-appointed monitor in the room, and I presume you're allowed to say the words climate change. It must be a relief to get back to communicating science to the public.
Yeah, I did run into some trouble, actually, in 2005 and 2006. But I must say that NOAA actually corrected itself after that. There were several NOAA scientists who were very unhappy with those developments. And NOAA and the Department of Commerce, under which NOAA resides, actually came up with a new communications policy in which, and this was the big advance, in which it was explicitly stated that we scientists have the last word in what we say to the public, and not NOAA, nor the NOAA, especially not the NOAA, say, public relations people. They can help us formulate our pronouncement or words to basically take the jargon out, but we have the last word, and that is crucial. So I feel no restrictions whatsoever. I can tell you what I think is happening and my best judgment.
Well, recently I went cruising around the site you're connected with, Carbon Tracker. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, it has a long history. We have been measuring CO2, carbon dioxide, and other greenhouse gases all over the world for many decades. We do that for two purposes, really. The first purpose is just record, beyond any reasonable doubt, how the increases are taking place. And we are very sure that what we are measuring is correct, because we are measuring that in many independent ways and with very carefully done calibrations. Again, independent calibrations by different labs. So we are very sure. And so we make a record that can really stand the test of time. But then we look carefully at very small differences in the abundance of CO2 as a function of time and space. And these very small differences actually reflect where the CO2 is emitted and where it's being absorbed. If you're downwind from a very large source, we see an enhancement of the CO2 abundance. And if we're downwind from a sink, say it's being absorbed in the southern oceans, for example, then in that area, we see that the abundance is slightly lower. And so as we monitor CO2 all over the world, we can actually translate that into spatial patterns of sources and sinks. Now, Carbon Tracker is a refinement on that we introduced in early 2007, in which we update annually. In that, we actually formalize our system of turning concentration patterns, abundance patterns, into patterns of sources and sinks, and which is updated not only once a year, but it takes into account additional information. So we do not only look at the CO2 concentrations as they are measured, but we take account of how the winds are flowing. I mean, how is air being brought to the site of measurement? We take into account information about the weather. For instance, if you have a sunny day in the summer, CO2 uptake is larger than when it's cloudy. When it's warmer, respiratory processes that are releasing CO2 will be going a little faster than when it's colder. And we take all of that information into account to create time-dependent patterns of sources and sinks, sources being emissions, sinks being removals of CO2 from the atmosphere.
Well, it's a bit of a surprise to me to find that carbon dioxide's not this fixed level. We see a number in the newspaper, 387 parts per million or whatever, but it really varies with the seasons and where you are in the world. It's a very flexible system, isn't it?
Yeah, it's these patterns that you mentioned that we make use of to diagnose what's happening. But there is an underlying, you could say, globally uniform background concentration. And it's going up every year. For example, the background concentration 10 years ago was about 20 ppm parts per million lower than today. So now global average is about 385 parts per million. 10 years ago, it was 365 parts per million. But that is almost uniform everywhere. So these small differences, the seasonal cycle, sure, it's an important feature. And at a site like Mauna Loa, which is the place where this carbon dioxide measurements really started in 1958, the seasonal cycle is, say, plus or minus 3 parts per million above and below that global uniform background, which in those days actually was something like 312 parts per million in 1958. But there was the seasonal cycle at 3 ppm higher at the end of winter and 3 ppm below that at the end of summer, which is caused by plants, ecosystems on land.
And how do you know how much comes from fossil fuel burning?
There's several ways. Again, here's a thing that we're very certain about. That is that the increase that we currently see is caused, I would say, 100%, plus or minus 5 maybe, by human beings. Why are we certain? There are several independent reasons for that. It's not just one line of reasoning. There are several lines of reasoning that all point in the same direction. And I say the first one is this, that we know by direct measurements how much CO2 has increased during the second half, especially, of the 20th century and continues to increase today. That's a number. It's the total amount added to the atmosphere. And then there are measurements in the oceans have also been done as a function of depth. And so we have a fairly solid idea of how much the total carbon dioxide content of the oceans has increased since pre-industrial times. So we have a number for that. You add up those two numbers, and within the uncertainty of those two numbers, which is, you know, approximately 10-15%, it is equal to the total amount burning of coal, oil, and natural gas. And that's actually based on economic records. How much coal have we burned from the start of the Industrial Revolution to today? How much oil? How much gas? And we add all that up in terms of CO2, and it is equal to what we observed, the sum of the atmosphere and the oceans to have increased. So that's one. That's a very strong argument, actually. But there's more. There's different kinds of carbon. There's carbon 12, which has 6 neutrons and 6 protons. And, you know, that's a nucleus, carbon nucleus, and it has an electron cloud around it. Then we have also carbon, and that makes then a carbon atom. Then we also have carbon 13, has an extra neutron. It acts chemically just like carbon, but it is slightly heavier. And we can measure that in the atmosphere very, very accurately. What's the point of that? It tells us what type of carbon we are looking at. It so happens that when plants photosynthesize, remove CO2 from the atmosphere, they discriminate against the uptake of carbon 13 O2 by a very small amount. So with the result is that organic matter is relatively depleted in carbon 13. And the oceans are not. So if the CO2 increase that we observe in the atmosphere, if you don't want to accept that it is from fossil fuel burning, which are depleted in C13, because fossil fuels have been derived from organic matter millions of years ago, if you don't want to accept that, you say, no, it could have come from the oceans, then you would have expected that the C13 abundance of the CO2 in the atmosphere would not have changed, because what comes out of the ocean has the same C13 abundance as what's already in the atmosphere. If, on the other hand, it has come from an organic source, it should have decreased the C13 in the atmosphere, and that's exactly what we observe. So what we observe in the atmosphere tells you, without knowing anything about fossil fuel burning, what it tells you is we are looking at an increase caused by somehow combustion of organic material. Now, there's another type of carbon. This carbon 14 has yet another neutron, and it is radioactive. So you and I all, and you know, all organic material on the surface of the Earth, and we eat that, we are built up of carbon that is relatively depleted in C13 because of what we eat. So we reflect that. However, the fossil fuels, since they're millions of years old, have no carbon-14 left in them. It has radioactively decayed. So we look at the atmospheric record, and there's clear evidence that the source of the CO2, of the CO2 increase in the atmosphere, is old, very old. So what we have is a source of very old organic material. Well, fossil fuels fit the bill, and not release of organic material from the terrestrial biosphere that has not caused, cannot have caused the bulk of the increase in the atmosphere. You see, so this is completely independent. If you don't know anything about the fact that we're burning fossil fuels, this is what the atmospheric record tells you directly.
And you mentioned the huge absorption of CO2 pollution by the ocean. I've just read a South Korean study from Pohang University. It says the ocean may be taking up much less carbon dioxide than before, at least in the Sea of Japan so far. Is the ocean buffer weakening, and if so, what does that mean for us?
Well, there's another word for carbon dioxide, and actually that is what they were using for this same molecule in the 19th century. They called it carbonic acid. So when CO2 in the atmosphere goes up, the CO2 will be exchanging with the ocean surface always at all times. And as soon as you dissolve gaseous CO2 in water, as soon as you do that, you have carbonic acid. So the oceans are acidifying, the ocean surface is, and it's a direct consequence, inescapable consequence of the increase of CO2 in the atmosphere. And that is actually pretty scary thing, because as the oceans acidify, coral reefs could get into serious trouble. If we continue doing this, then at some point coral reefs will have serious problems surviving.
Green 960 AM in San Francisco and around the world at green960.com. I'm Alex Smith, and this is the Radio EcoShock Show. We're talking with carbon tracker Peter Tans from NOAA. I was more worried that the ocean itself may not be able to continue taking up the pollution we're putting out.
Well, at the moment, I see no evidence that the oceans are slowing down.
Okay.
I know I've read some reports claiming that the oceans are slowing down its uptake of CO2, but I do not see that in the atmosphere. So you could say that might be somewhat controversial at the moment. Just, I do not buy that at this point.
We'll leave that as an open question.
Yeah.
I was surprised we don't yet have a real-time measuring system. It still takes time to get all those samples and send them in and analyze the results. Am I right to say we don't know the current state of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere?
Well, we know the current state fairly well in the sense that, yeah, we know that it continues to go up, and we know that on a monthly basis, I mean near real-time. We have actually a mixed observing system. We rely fairly heavily on flask samples that are taken, individual air samples in flasks that are sent back to our laboratory that we analyze here. But we also have continuously measuring instruments in a number of places. And we're actually gradually increasing the number of continuous, you could say, real-time measurements. So we have a mixed system. And so we can actually follow the increase at a place like Mauna Loa in real time. And when we correct for the seasonal cycle, which is pretty much repeats itself every year, we can construct, a de-seasonalized record. And almost every single month, the de-seasonalized trend increases at Mauna Loa. And that is near real time.
So if we had a big burst of carbon, as we had in Indonesia when they burned down the peat forests in 97 and 98, your system would pick it up, and you'd be able to advise governments about that?
Oh, yeah, we saw that very, very clearly. There was a burst of several billion tons of carbon connected with those fires, yes. It was not only CO2 coming out, it was also carbon monoxide coming out, actually, and a lot of, semi-oxidized gases.
Not good.
Yeah.
Well, this carbon tracking seems so crucial for the next round of emission controls as well as the climate as a whole. What sort of improvements do you and other scientists, what do you want to see in the improvements of carbon tracking?
So what we're currently able to see is how sources and things behave over relatively large spatial areas, because our current observing system is somewhat sparse. And it's partially because the technical requirements of the measurements are actually quite demanding. Since we get this information about sources and sinks from the relatively small enhancements and depletions of the concentration, we need to be able to measure very precisely. See, there's this global background that I talked to you about, right? 385 parts per million now, which is the same everywhere. The signals that we're trying to interpret are, you know, plus or minus a few parts per million, either above or below that 385. So we need to measure that very accurately. So it is not so simple. I mean, it takes a fair amount of effort as well as carefully calibrated equipment, etc. That's why we have a relatively small number of sites. Now, we could increase the spatial specificity of Carbon Tracker in our measurements if we were able to get support to increase the number of monitoring sites. We are certainly trying to do that. What we would like to be able to do in the near future is have enough of an observing density in collaboration with with states, maybe large metropolitan areas. We'd like to increase our density of observation so that we could say something specific about smaller areas, say down to the scale of a U.S. state or a Canadian province, or a main source area such as a large urban area, to basically verify to what extent emissions reductions policies are effective. I think this is going to be important that we can do this. There's a lot of money involved. I mean, to reform or basically transform our entire energy system to make it an emissions-free system is going to take trillions of dollars total. So this is going to be a lot of money. Or to put it in another way, you know, the value, I'll give you a number, the value of U.S. emissions, total U.S. CO2 emissions, if I take the price for CO2 emissions that was on the European Carbon Exchange, the London Carbon Exchange, in the middle of last year, the price was 28 euro per ton of CO2. If I take that number and multiply that with total U.S. emissions, those would be worth $250 billion every year. So there's a lot of money involved, which means that there's going to be a lot of wishful thinking and claims that some policy is effective, that maybe, you know, carbon credits may be basically issued and traded on the exchange. It's quite important that we have some objective system to keep all of this grounded in reality. And that's what we hope to be able to provide. And also we think we can if we are enabled to increase the density of our observations.
We are talking with Peter Tans, chief scientist of a NOAA project that measures global greenhouse gases. Their web address is a bit too long for radio, but listeners, if you Google NOAA and carbon cycle, that's N-O-A-A and carbon cycle, it'll come right up to the top of the pile. You'll see the climate monitoring lab there. Peter, I wish we were talking about some other planet in a reserved scientific way, but this is our home and our children's future. What concerns you most about the new information on changes to the atmosphere?
I tell you what I'm most concerned about, and that is, there's really two things. First is, now, we're not talking about potentially a few degrees warming during this current century. I'm really most worried about the substantial probability that there are climate feedbacks in the system that will make climate change so large that it can only be called catastrophic, you know, for our society, that is. There is a finite chance that feedbacks, which we have not been able to quantify very well, but I'll give you an example of a feedback like this. There's an enormous amount of carbon is stored in permafrost in Arctic areas, and they are warming, actually more rapidly than the global mean warming. This may lead to a destabilization of that frozen material. It may thaw out and basically get transformed by microbes into methane and CO2, adding an enormous source of both greenhouse gases over which we have no control, further increasing the warming that way. That's a risk that we run. And unfortunately, it's, I think, a substantial risk, but we have not been able to put a hard number on it so far. Now, and there are other potential feedbacks. And so what that translates to into climate predictions is that there's a finite chance, maybe let's say 1 in 6 or something like that, that the climate, that the warming on, say, the continents, which is more higher, expected to be higher than over the oceans, might be as much as, 10 degrees C. And this is what I call catastrophic. That's what I'm worried about.
Yeah, that's a new hot state world where mammals like us might not do very well, along with most of what
I'm worried about food production, for example.
Yeah.
That we might run into water. What's going to happen to the availability of water? Because the water demands from plants will increase when the temperature increases. So that's really what I'm talking about. That's the risk that we're taking. And it is somewhat of an unknown risk, and it is difficult to quantify because it's very sensitive to the strength of the feedback. And, as long as we have not pinned down these feedbacks, all we can do is talk about a probability. And unfortunately, the probability is not close to zero. That's from all the information that we do have. It's not, say, 60 or 70% either, but maybe 10% or 1 in 6, or which I think is still actually unacceptably large.
Well, who wants to take a chance of driving off a cliff? I'm hoping that the kind of information that you're driving at your center, now that it's getting maybe to better leadership, will result in people putting on the brakes and maybe we can convert over to the carbonless society.
Yeah, I think we actually have an opportunity. This is, in a sense, it's very sad, of course, that we have this global economic recession. But actually, it's at the same time an opportunity, and I really hope our government is going to take it. We need to create jobs. The one way to get out of a recession, of course, is just create jobs. And I think that the new administration wants to really focus a lot of these new jobs on creating a new energy economy. For example, the low-hanging fruit in this to get to a zero, eventually, first a low-emissions energy system and eventually zero emissions, the low-hanging fruit, I think, is efficiency and conservation. Certainly in the U.S., building stock is not all that energy efficient. And the technology to make them energy efficient, even not just new buildings, but retrofit old buildings, is there. We know how to do it. So I'd say, let's do it. And it creates jobs, a massive amount of jobs.
And we could cut down those carbon plumes. Well, we've been talking with Peter Tans, the chief scientist for NOAA project to measure greenhouse gases. Thank you so much for your valuable time, Peter.
It's my pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Find this interview as a free MP3 download at our website, ecoshock.org. That's it for this week, and thank you for tuning in. Get Real Green Radio, the Radio EcoShock show, every Saturday morning at 11:30 on Green 960 AM, San Francisco, and green960.com.